Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
Welcome to Development Hell. For every horror movie that hits VOD, countless others end up DOA. Development Hell is the podcast dedicated to unearthing these cursed horror productions. We're going to find out what went wrong and then decide if these titles still stand a shot at the green light. I am your host, Josh Korngut. I am a filmmaker in Toronto, Canada. This podcast is a proud member of the Dread Podcast Network. And we're going. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Development Hell. Today is the first episode of our brand new miniseries, Christmas is Cancelled. We're going to be covering the secret histories and alternate realities behind some of the most iconic Christmas horror movies. Today, we are covering our very first of our four-episode arc, and we're digging up everything Black Christmas. Our co-host for Christmas is Cancelled, all four episodes, is going to be Jinx. Welcome back to the podcast, Jinx. How's it going?
Josh, how are you? Thank you very much for having me back.
Sure, everyone knows you by now, but for the new people, how would you introduce yourself? Who are you? What's your whole deal?
Oh, gosh. I'm a writer and podcaster. You can find my stuff at Bloody Disgusting, where I have a few different columns that have been on ice recently, but I am hoping to resurrect them soon. I write Phantom Limbs about unmade horror sequels and remakes. I write Larval Inc. about early versions of produced movies. What the hell else do I write? I write a comic book column called Blood, Ink, and Staples. And I write something called Mask of Insanity, which is all about delving into fun stories behind the makings of some slashers or monsters or this and that. I only have a handful of those up, but I've had a lot of fun with them. And then besides that, I host a podcast called Scream Addicts, which is currently in the midst of a side project called Hammer Pub. Basically, have a few drinks, and we provide a running commentary for a Hammer horror movie, the likes of which used to star Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing and what. But no, I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm so happy to finally, you know, have you as a co-host. I feel For this, Christmas is Cancelled. You heard it here, guys. Jinx is co-host. He is bringing this to you every week, and we are thrilled. We have finally human trafficked Jinx to Development Hell for at least 4 weeks, and we couldn't be happier about it. As I mentioned, today we are covering Black Christmas. Now, usually in Development Hell, we're covering things that have not seen the light of day, but for this detour that we're taking into Christmas is Cancelled, we're digging into secret histories, alternate realities, unproduced scripts, all the fun stuff surrounding all of our favorite Christmas horror movies. And I'm wondering, Jinx, What's your general relationship with Black Christmas?
Oh, Black Christmas. I adore Black Christmas, the 1974 film. It's funny, I discovered the first movie back in the 90s when I was growing up a burgeoning horror fan. I was in love with Fangoria. You know, I was the kid who would pester my local book stand. It was Tim's News and Novelties in Ironton, Ohio, ages ago. I would call every Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday and ask when the newest issue would be in. And for issue 159, which Josh and I have been hunting for recently, and we can fill listeners in on that if you want, Josh. But back in the day when I picked up issue 159, it had a Mars Attacks cover. I think it was a Christmas issue. In addition to covering all of the newer films that were coming out, much like all the previous Fangos that I picked up until that point, that particular issue provided retrospectives on these two Christmas movies leading into the holiday season. And one was Christmas Evil, which is an amazing movie and is easily the second best Christmas horror movie ever. And it also provided a retrospective for Black Christmas, which was a movie that I'd never heard of. And then all of a sudden, you know, this is right around the time that Scream was coming out. I had just sort of dove headfirst into the Halloween series and various slashers to sort of bone up on my slasher knowledge as an up-and-coming horror fan. And then all of a sudden, I'm discovering that there is this movie that was kind of a proto-slasher that predated Halloween, but still kind of did all of the same stuff. And after reading it, I immediately consulted the latest Movies Unlimited catalog. For listeners out there, if we can all cast back to the 90s before there was, the internet or streaming options, when you actually had to work to watch movies that weren't readily available at your local mom and pop video store. I used this company called Movies Unlimited that would provide catalogs, and I would basically just mostly look at the catalog and wish that I could watch every movie that was in there. But every great once in a while, I would save up a little bit of money and I would send off for a VHS. And after reading that retrospective, I knew that I needed Black Christmas in my life. Mm-hmm. And so I bought it and I got to watch it before Christmas that year. And I absolutely adored it. It scared the living hell out of me, made me think, which is not easy to do. And it was utterly indelible, and it has remained one of my favorite horror movies, one of my favorite slasher movies. I think it still holds up to this day, and I absolutely adore it.
I can't blame you for that, Jinx. It is very, very classic. I don't know why we have to pit our female artists against each other, but I always wonder, you know, what do I like more? Black Christmas or Halloween, and I do oscillate between the two. I think sometimes I do it because I like to scandalize people into telling them that I like something more than Halloween. You know what? But I have to say, like, Taylor Swift and Beyonce, like, we don't have to put them against each other. They're two incredible artists, and they bring very important pop to our community. Black Christmas is incredible. I saw it very young, I think early into my horror career. And I don't think I was expecting it to be as scary as it was. I am a Toronto native, and I'm also obsessed with how this movie just shows Toronto off at her most beautiful. And I am an alumni of the University of Toronto, and U of T is just splattered all over this movie, very urban legend style. So it really itches all of that for me, and I'm excited for us to get a little bit into that. Jinx, I know you know all this already, but some people at home maybe don't, maybe want a refresher. Would you allow me to give a bit of a seminar on the original Black Christmas?
Please do.
So Black Christmas, originally titled Silent Night, Evil Night, incredible, 1974 Canadian horror film directed by Bob Clark, written by A. Roy Moore. So the general setup of this film is we've got a house of sorority sisters who are receiving lewd and bizarre threatening phone calls. There are some murders in the neighborhood, like a 13-year-old girl is found dead in a park, and eventually a deranged stalker emerges from the attic in the sorority house, kills a bunch of people, and that's the setup of the film. So it was made for around $620,000 and raked in $4 million, which I'm assuming was like $10 billion in 1974.
This it was like little, Titanic yeah, money.
It must have been. It's ginormous. It had two remakes, one in 2006, one in 2019. This movie is kind of based on the babysitter and the man upstairs urban legend. And this urban legend, which we're all familiar with the babysitter, and she gets a phone call, and there's a man inside the house, and he's saying, you know, the children, check on the children, and then she dies, and there's a clown sometimes. We're all familiar with it. Black Christmas is also one of the first horror movies to use the POV from the killer, which is then popularized by Halloween and Friday the 13th. It's an incredible movie.
Oh, Black Christmas, absolutely. This movie, much like, you know, we can talk at length about the pros and cons of the following Black Christmases later, if you'd like. Because I think that would be a lot of fun. But
we're getting there.
You know, the one thing that sort of unites them all is the fact that they each have kind of an impressive pedigree. Mm-hmm. Certainly this movie does, with Bob Clark having directed it.
Can you tell us just like quickly, like, who is Bob Clark? What's this guy's deal?
Yes, absolutely. Bob Clark is a guy that you might know for making some of your favorite movies.
Yeah.
But what's crazy about him is that he never pigeonholed himself to one specific genre. He is known for Black Christmas, sure, but he also made a Sherlock Holmes movie called Murder by Decree that also features Jack the Ripper, and the movie is incredible.
Cool.
In addition to that, he also made another great Christmas movie called A Christmas Story.
Damn.
That's right. The Red Rider, the You'll Shoot Your Eye Out Kid, the Leg Lamp. That's all.
The Leg
him.
Lamp. Which, you know what? The Leg Lamp definitely has Black Christmas vibes a little bit.
100%. Like, it should have.
Which is incredible.
You know, it should have been like the Oculus mirror that Flanagan uses all the time. Like, that damn Funny. Leg lamp. Well, what's crazy is that the leg lamp could have shown up in all of Clark's movies. It could have been in Black Christmas as well as A Christmas Story. It could have been in Porky's. Like, it totally would have been at home.
It would have been Porky's. You know, huge Porky energy.
And it could have been in Murder by Decree. You know, it could have been in Watson's study, maybe. Who knows?
The murder weapon.
But no, Bob Clark, was such a great director. He made so many good movies, including... he also made this great film back in 72. It predated Black Christmas by a couple of years. That was kind of like loosely based on The Monkey's Paw, but it was like this post-Vietnam movie called Death Dream. Have you ever seen it?
No.
Oh, you definitely need to check that out. But no, he's honestly, you cannot go wrong with a Bob Clark movie. Some of his later movies, like, you know what? I'm not even going to knock them. I have never seen Baby Geniuses or Super Babies, Baby Geniuses 2.
Oh my God, he made the Baby Geniuses movies? I did not know.
Yeah, I can't knock him for those, though, because I never saw them. So I think that's
unfair. I only hear the second one is like the worst film of all time. I don't think the first one is on that list, but maybe I'm wrong.
Okay, I don't know.
I feel like it's like Mask 2 level, negative energy.
Oh, that's tough.
Son of Mask.
But yeah, Bob Clark is brilliant. So to have him at the helm of this movie, and then as you noted, like, such a great cast. We have Olivia Hussey as our lead.
Damn.
Known for Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet, and later she would pop up as the utterly batshit insane version of Mrs. Bates in Mick Garris's Psycho for the Beginning, with Keir D'Elia, who was in 2001, you know, Kubrick. We have Margot Kidder, who's only a stone's throw away from doing an Amityville Horror. We have John Saxon about a decade before he played Nancy's dad. And you know what? He never aged. He looked the way he did in 72, the way he did for the rest of his life. You know, I don't know. He was a vampire. But I love John Saxon. I really do. And then, as far as like the really noteworthy cast members, of course, we have SCTV's Andrea Martin as well. And it was wonderful that she would eventually pop up later on in Black Christmas 2006. But we're not there yet. But no, such a great cast.
They're all so hot. Olivia Hussey must have been just the hottest person on the planet in 1974. She's just so hot in this movie, and I can't take my eyes off her. She's so funny. There's this quote from, Margot Kidder was interviewed not long ago about her experience on it. And apparently she got really close with a lot of people on the cast. But apparently Olivia Hussey was like strange, a bit of an odd duck. And she was obsessed with telling people that her psychic was going to help her get Paul McCartney to fall in love with her. And apparently they like were kind of not nice to her because she was like really weird and eccentric, which I just find very funny.
You know, I hope that she wound up having an affair.
I mean, he would be only so lucky.
He honestly, I mean, why, you know, why not that? That if I were a Beatle, I would totally probably pursue.
Hello. Like, oh, in 19th. Yeah. Hottest girl on the planet. Can I tell you my like only vaguely interesting shooting location connection to Olivia Hussey?
Oh, please.
Okay. So as I mentioned, this film is Toronto, the musical, like University of Toronto. It's just like my hometown in a nutshell and the university that I went to. So that's really exciting. That is my one connection to a movie that Olivia Hussey was in. My second is a small town in Italy by the name of Gubbio. My family grew up there in the summers. I had this kind of eccentric grandpa, and he was a doctor in Toronto, and he learned Italian really well so he could treat the Italian population here. And then he bought this like very isolated, crumbling, like looming estate in like rural Italy in like the 60s. And so my mom and her sisters had to go live there in the summertime to the small town where Romeo and Juliet was filmed.
I'm sorry, can I just ask one question? Did you say they had to go and live in the Italian castle?
It is a castle. And I was like, do I say castle? But yeah, so it was a castle. But no, they had to and they hated it.
What?
Because it had no running water, to what I understand, for at least the first few years. And there were many scorpions. So my mom, as privileged as they were to spend summers in a castle in Italy, apparently it was like not, it was like living in a castle in Italy in like the 1700s. But it's a part of my lineage that I am a little bit obsessed with.
Josh, and yeah. When are you shooting a horror movie at this family estate?
It's so sad. So it's been, so yes, it was sold in 2007.
No.
Which is very sad. It's very, very sad. And then I believe it's turned into, I think it's either a private property or maybe it's a hotel now. So I'm obsessed with this place. And I did visit it a couple times in my life. I was lucky enough to see it. And it is creepy as hell. And it's right next to the town where they shot Olivia Hussey as Juliet and Romeo and Juliet. And when I went to go visit Gubbio not long ago, I was like, whoa, this is the place. So yeah, those are my two weird familial connections to Olivia Hussey's shooting location. Yeah, so that's Olivia Hussey. Other people in it, Andrea Martin, incredible in it. I know she's not, but I really would love to interpret her as queer-coded. I really want to look at Andrea Martin's character in Black Christmas as queer-coded, because she just has a queer energy to me. She looks like a queer girl in 2021.
Oh, I, as a straight guy, I have no opinion or desire to comment one way or another.
Okay. that is fair and safe and wise of you. But as a queer, I have to say, I was getting queer energy. And there's a scene in like near the beginning where they're having like a party in the sorority house. And she's like talking very close. And I think it's either to Olivia Hussey or to Margot Kidder. And it was just like very hot. And I really ship all of those girls together.
I would watch that movie with just the three of them.
Yeah, I mean, why?
Like
not
quietly hitting on one another.
Yeah. Which I think they were. I think that they were. And they would have been better off because all the dudes in that movie were scumbaggerinas.
They really were. Like even, mm-hmm. Even the likable ones were unlikable to a certain degree.
Oh, exactly. I actually think that this movie was really progressive in a lot of ways. Yeah, it came out 1 year after Roe versus Wade. And it came out guns a-blazing with, like, a very thoughtful abortion subplot. Do you want to, like, give us a little bit of a rundown on, like, how, like, what that subplot sort of entailed?
Yeah, so our lead in the movie, Olivia Hussey's character, Jess, she has learned that she's pregnant and she is going to have an abortion. And this is something that she runs by her boyfriend, which is Keir D'Elia's, or D'Elia? D'Elia? Doesn't matter. She runs by her boyfriend, Peter. And Peter sort of takes the hardline stance that she is not going to have an abortion. And so this is a point of contention between them. And just the way that particular struggle is handled in this movie, like it could have been so easy, especially for two male filmmakers at the helm. You know, you have Bob Clark, obviously, and then you have Roy Moore, who wrote the script. I think it would have been so easy to make that subplot sensational. Mm-hmm. I think they handled, being fair, we have to be honest here. Like, obviously that subplot is used to build Peter as a red herring. Yes.
Yes.
But in addition to that, I think they handled that subplot with a good deal of sensitivity for the amount of time that subplot is on screen and how
Definitely.
It plays out. And it's, you know, to me, that is sort of a through line from this particular movie to the 2019, I mean, we can call it a remake, but it's not really a remake at all. We'll get there, I'm sure, but...
Reboot.
Rethinking, whatever the hell, recalibration. Reclaiming of a title to tell a completely different story. Yeah, who knows? But you know, the one through line between those two movies, the 74 film and the 2019 film, in addition to just being about young women who run afoul of stabby stalkers in a sorority house, it seems to be this idea, you know, the subtext of men sort of imposing their will on women and our heroines, you know, being revealed as the ones who stand defiant in the face of that, you know, and in very different ways. Like, obviously that is, you know, that underscores the absolute villainy in the 2019 version. Whereas in the 74 movie, you know, Peter is ultimately revealed to not be the ultimate, like the main villain of the piece. But he is still a guy who thinks that he has a claim on this woman's body. And it's funny that we're talking about this right now after a week of everybody being on pins and needles as to whether or not Roe versus Wade is going to be overturned. It is such an interesting note for this movie to play. It could have been a simple slasher. And even if it had been, it would have been a marvelously made, wonderfully acted slasher film. But the fact that there's this extra little subplot in there gives the entire movie so much more weight than it otherwise would have had.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And it gives Jess some agency. She's able to stand up for what she wants. She is able to make her own decisions about her body, even though other people are telling her that she can't. And this is in 1974, as we're saying, 1 year after Roe versus Wade. And, you know, it's creating a archetype of a character of the final girl that will eventually go on to have to be chased. And in this one, we're getting a character that, you know, has had premarital sex, has become pregnant, is made the decision to get an abortion. She is still our first ever final girl and like has no apologies to be made about any of that stuff. So I think it was maybe an accident that it came out as sensitive as it did, but it's really cool that this movie went that route.
Can I say one controversial thing here while we're talking about it? Because while you and I think are in complete agreement, regarding the subplot. And while I am on Jess's side 100%, I do think it is kind of fucked up that she told him right before his recital. Say one thing, if I say anything in Peter's defense, I will say that her telling him right before that is fucked up. Like,
you know what? Fuck Peter, though, because no matter how messed up, no matter how much this disturbed his day, he clearly doesn't know how to play the piano. So he should not be in this conservatory because he was just doing what I would be doing. It's just like slapping random keys and sweating a lot. So I'm not convinced Peter actually knows how to play the piano. So
he definitely couldn't do it under pressure. That's a fact.
No. Yeah. Fuck Peter. And it's the most drastic red herring I've ever seen in a horror film, where like they really like go for it almost too much. Like it's I don't think it's fair to like just be like, this is the killer, and then it kind of not being, but it's okay. It also doesn't make any sense. Like, why is he breaking into the basement randomly for the first time in his life?
What I love about that is that you could almost make a version of the movie from Peter's point of view. Don't anybody do that. David Gordon, away from Peter.
I'd secretly watch Christmas. It. Yeah, fuck you, Peter.
I would 100% watch it, but I don't want it to exist.
Yeah.
But there is a version of Peter's story where he probably came rushing in at the end, like, you know, the knight in shining armor ready to save the day. And to me, there is something kind of hilarious about the fact that this guy feels like he's probably fulfilling that role at the end only to have the ending that he does. You know, I think it's kind of like darkly hilarious.
That she kills him. I love that she kills him. And also good for her for murdering him and then passing out right away afterwards, I guess.
Yeah, that's the one thing. But you know what? Like, she's had a tough day.
She looks great for having such a bad day, though. When she, like, wakes up with her doll eyes fluttering open so quietly when they're, like, I love that moment.
Okay, be honest with me. At the end, even though it's kind of fucked up, do you at all ship John Saxon's Lieutenant Fuller and Jess at all? Like just a little bit.
Oh,
like,
I mean, I yeah. Okay, listen, I do, but in a way that's like off the record, completely off the record. It's in the same way that I ship Buffy and Giles. Like, it's so inappropriate, but you know it would be happening.
You know, one late night study session at that library.
Oh, like, everyone's, and he's in his tweed and she's working out, I guess. Black Christmas was going to have its broadcast television, like primetime premiere, in January 28th, 1978, about 4 years after it was released into cinemas. And it was all set to be released on TV. And 2 weeks prior to this television premiere, the Chi Omega sorority house in Florida State University, but in Tallahassee, there was a horrifying double murder where two sisters were murdered in their own beds when they were asleep, terribly, terribly beaten to death. And the killer that perpetrated this horrible act went to a nearby room in the sorority house and then violently attacked two more sleeping girls who did survive. And then down the line, it was revealed that the killer behind these horrible assaults and attacks was Ted Bundy. Yeah, so, but because of this attack in 1978, they had to pull the Black Christmas television premiere because of, you know, the violence against sorority girls specifically. So because of the Ted Bundy attacks, this movie was actually pulled from TV, and that version was going to be titled Stranger in the House. So there's a strange Ted Bundy connection to this film, which is really upsetting and fascinating, actually.
Yeah, I had only heard about that in passing. That is it's kind of crazy and creepy.
It's really creepy. Margot Kidder are just... What a treat, Margot Kidder. She won basically the Canadian Oscar, or at the time was known as the Canadian Film Award, for Best Lead Actress in this film. This film was also nominated for Best Film, so cool. I think it's sort of deserved, although I wouldn't call Margot Kidder's performance the lead role by any means, but why not?
No, but can I just say, go Canada. I like... that, you know, here in the States, the Oscars kind of turn their nose up to horror movies.
Hell yeah.
I mean, Toni Collette, Hereditary, where was that nomination, let alone win? You know, Margot Kidder won for Best Actress in Black Christmas. I mean, that's kind of amazing.
And, you know what, I'm going to say not deserved. That character was annoying and weird. Why was she making that baby drink alcohol? Very inappropriate.
You know, she was a free spirit, Josh. So
and why is she like, there's a man whose daughter is missing and she's like yelling at him about turtles fucking. I just don't think that's appropriate.
You know, if she didn't win you over with, fucking with the cop.
Oh, that was incredible.
And the fellatio.
The fellatio scene was truly, truly incredible.
No, it's a new exchange. You know that, mm-hmm. I mean, I adore that character. I really do.
I do too, but it was just like a little weird. Oh, and then she says that weird thing. Oh, she says like a not pro victim line early in the film. Do you know what I'm alluding to?
Okay, I'll say it. Yeah. Okay,
say that today.
That was not like great.
Lewd rape joke by that character.
You know, she liked to shock people. She was a shock comedian. She didn't mean it.
Shock comic. An amazing death scene though. That sequence is
probably one of the most genuinely disturbing slasher killings I can think of.
So well set up with the kids, and also just like one of the most beautiful shots in cinema history with Olivia Hussey by the door with like in the red light of the wreath.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Oh my God. This movie is so beautiful. And the glass. Swans and the glass unicorn, all that shit was just art.
It's a beautiful, like, there are many sequences in this movie that like Clark is so smart to film them in such a way that they're gorgeous and upsetting all at once, and he really knows how to stage a good killing, you know,
truly. And there's like in Halloween, like there's a little bit of blood, but like you don't have any practical gore. You don't like see any kind of like like flesh getting torn up or anything. You just see a little bit of blood after the fact. But the way they do it, it's kind of like Psycho. It's like they cut it just right.
Yeah.
Especially that Margot Kidder scene.
Do you think, scary. Now that you mention that, I've never considered that before, but do you think that Clark had Psycho in mind when he did Margot Kidder's death scene?
Definitely. I will say Bob Clark died on my birthday when I was in grade 12, and it haunts me to this day. I think about it all the time.
Such a horrible... I remember, I think I was at work. I was working at a movie theater at the time when I found out that he and his son had been... What was it? They were hit and killed by a fucking drunk. And I just... It's so damn sad that, you know...
What a loss for all cinema. Because he's, you know, he's done everything. He has a classic all over the place, that guy.
I really do believe that given the opportunity, like if he were still with us today... That man would have revisited Black Christmas by now, I think.
Do you think so?
I think so. And not just, you know, I know that we had the Black Christmas in 2006, but that was spearheaded by the Weinsteins. I'm sure they only gave a rat's ass about the title. But, I mean, you know, if we had Bob Clark around 16, 17, 18, around in there, I feel like it wouldn't even have to, it doesn't even have to be a Halloween 2018 reference. But I'm just saying,
yes, it would be
somebody
like
a Jason Blum might have been like, hey, why don't you help us launch, you know, Black Christmas?
Maybe he would have, he would have like connected him with Sophia Tikal, sort of like Green was connected with Carpenter.
Totally. Like have him, you know, have him come in and produce, have him spearhead the thing, you know, why not?
Mm-hmm. Get his, you know, his sort of POV on it. Maybe.
Yeah.
Could have been interesting. That's sort of what the trend of what they're doing now. Oh, yeah, because they're doing it with Scream, because they're getting Kevin Williamson as an executive producer.
Yeah, 100%. And
are they doing it with the Texas Chainsaw? Because Texas Chainsaw is going the same route, where it's like the same title, but they're calling it a sequel. Just like Scream, just like Halloween.
What's crazy is that the Texas Chainsaw franchise already pulled that shit once in 2013. It predated this trend by about a half a decade.
Was that Texas Chainsaw 3D?
Yep, it did the same thing, where it's like, you know what? We're forgetting all of the other movies. We're going right back to the original. We're making a direct sequel. And, you know,
and
now whenever we...
the same title, basically.
Exactly. You know, and now, you know, whenever we think of somebody doing that, it's like, well, it's doing the Halloween 2018 thing. It's like, nah, doing the Texas Chainsaw 3D.
If that movie was a little better, maybe we would give it a little bit more of a fair shake. Do your thing, cuz I did a whole article not that long about that line. It's such a funny line.
I do honestly think if it didn't feel so damned insulting what they do with the lead character's age throughout the course of the movie, I think I might have been able to enjoy it as a fun, dumb slasher movie. But that is just, it's one step too far. Like, I cannot enjoy the movie because of what they do with her age. And the fact that they know what they did, and they know we know, and they still try it anyway.
I will say she is a phenomenal actor.
Alexandra Daddario, she
is, oh my God, yeah,
really marvelous in that. She's a great
fucking great
actor, and I don't think she quite gets the credit that she should just because
she was in The White Lotus.
Which I have not... No, I take that back. I've seen the first episode, and I liked it. I haven't seen any more, though.
I think she's finally, I feel like, getting her flowers because of White Lotus, which is kind of the whole theme of White Lotus, because it's what they did to Jennifer Coolidge, too. So, gotta love any chance in the horror community to talk about White Lotus. I'm gonna take it.
I think that's only fair.
Thank you. Any other performances in this film that you think we need to touch base on? There's also the famous Lynn Griffin.
Lynn Griffin was Claire, right?
Yes, I think so. Were you thinking of the house mother?
I was thinking of Marianne Waldman as the alcoholic Mrs. Mack. Yes.
What a weird... I just found her so sad, but the movie was not portraying it as sad. They're like making fun of her alcoholism, but I was like, this is so sad.
I don't think it's sad because she's having a blast.
She is having a blast. She's having the time of her life.
She is living her life. She is having a great time.
She hates the girls, actually. She's very judgmental.
She is. That's a fact.
She makes that comment about how they would like get on top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa if they could figure it out, which is what a burn.
Love that character so much.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I felt bad that she had to hide her booze everywhere. She was clearly suffering from alcoholism.
Was she suffering?
You know, this is all about perspective. And I guess alcoholism was not a disease in 1974. It was a lifestyle.
Exactly. It was, you know, it just meant you were fun at parties. So
exactly. We didn't have the same language at the time. Her death scene is pretty iconic too.
Agree. Oh my God. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's on some of the ad art, I believe. Not all of it, but.
Oh,
some.
Is it? I love that. I found the Japanese poster or one of the Japanese posters for the original film. And it's so incredible.
Love it. I yeah, I adore it. No, Claire, I'm sorry. The missing daughter, right? Lynn Griffin.
Oh, the first.
Yes. Is great. She was also in Curtains, which is a movie I adore.
Canadian icon, if I'm not mistaken.
Nice. Good deal.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I mean, this movie, I think, is just sterling all around. I can't really mm-hmm. think of any weaknesses it has. I think horror owes a great debt to it. I don't think, and we can talk about this later, and I'm certain we're going to, like, I don't believe we would have Halloween without it. I don't care if that's controversial to say or not. It's true.
No way. Yeah, you were absolutely right.
But no, Black Christmas, I think, is just honestly a masterwork of the genre. I really think so. And
what do you give it out of 10? How many glass figurine unicorns out of 10 do you give it?
All of them. So,
me too.
Yeah,
this is a 10 for sure.
It's, you know, it's not often that we can use the word perfect when it comes to horror films, and I think this movie is perfect.
Yeah, like kind of like Halloween in a way.
Yeah,
it absolutely has that Halloween perfection, just like Chef's Kiss. Yes, and now, because it's Christmas, it has mood just baked in, sort of like Halloween, actually.
Now I have to ask you, because we talked a moment ago about this movie and the 2019 film and the mm-hmm. fact that they both kind of have a bit more on their minds than a mere slashery. Mm-hmm. I don't think the 2006 movie has that much going on in the attic. You can tell me
that's
if
funny. Was that a purpose? Was that a purposeful funny?
You know, no. I regretted it about a second before, you know, I knew it was wrong, but I said it anyway.
But it's so right. No, but you're right. The cream filling of this trio is definitely lacking in the thoughtfulness department.
Yeah. But I will say this. Can I speak about my experience with 2006?
I would love that, because that's where we're going.
Okay. So Black Christmas 2006, or Black Xmas, if you want to consider it.
Which I prefer, by the way.
I do too, actually. Yeah, because, it kind of sets it aside from the other movies.
It tells you what it is. It's honest.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was super excited to see this movie when it came out back in 2006. I was kind of a big fan of Miramax and Dimension's insistence on counter-programming horror movies at Christmas time. Scream and The Darkness and Wolf Creek and The Darkness, the Jaume Balaguerra film came out. You know, so they kind of had a knack for releasing dark stuff right at Christmas and always seemed to clean up for it. I tell you, I worked at a movie theater during some of these, and I never would have thought that of all the movies to play the week of Christmas, that Wolf Creek would be the one that would sell out its damned auditorium, but that's what happened.
We're fucked. We are just not. Human beings are just fucked up, and I celebrate that for us.
But, you know, Black Christmas, I was such a fan of the original. And I tell you, had anybody at all, just any old director picked up the reins of Black Christmas, a movie that I've just spoken at length about why I love. Mm-hmm. Had anybody done that, I would have been the guy who was crossing his arms saying, like, yeah, you just try and impress me, right? But the fact that it was the team of Glenn Morgan and James Wong, you know, guys whose work together that I've loved going back to the X-Files, you know, just a few years prior, they did a great remake of Willard, which I adore.
That was before. That was 2003-ish, right?
Yes. Yeah. Just a few years prior, they did like...
Very weird movie. Very weird remake.
It is.
And not in a bad way. Very like... It needs to be talked about more.
Oh, I adore it. I adored that movie. But so the fact that they were doing it, I was like, you know what? This is in great hands. This is going to be a great movie. And, you know, you look at the cast. We had, like I mentioned, Michelle Trachtenberg. We had Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who wasn't quite amazing. Mary Elizabeth Winstead at that
point. She was on her way.
She was like Mary Elizabeth at that point.
Yeah.
Like Mary Elizabeth Winstead, dot, dot, dot. She's getting there.
She's coming. Yeah.
Mary Elizabeth Winstead loading. You know, we had Lacey Chabert. We had, you know, Andrea Martin returned.
I watched this last night because I wanted to, like, I don't know. It's been forever. Lacey is in it. What's her face? From Mean Girls is in it. I was shocked.
Where did she go? Where is she?
You know, did you know she was the voice of Meg for the first two seasons of Family Guy?
Yeah, and then they replaced her. What the hell?
So apparently she wouldn't come back. So they got canceled. And when they managed to come back on the air, they were like, please come back. And she was like, fuck you guys, no way. And then it blew up, and apparently they make fun of her all the time. Apparently they're always making jokes about, like, how she really fucked up. And she really did, because I'm sure they're raking in the money for that one.
Bad decision. What did she think? That she was going to get multiple Mean Girls sequels coming out?
And now she's, like, in a bunch of Hallmark movies, but we still celebrate her.
Oh, that's a shame, Lacey. Come on.
And Katie Cassidy of Nightmare on Elm Street 2010 fame.
Katie Cassidy, who is another actor that I really, really like, that I wonder, like, where has she gone? Like, she was so good in Supernatural. She played, I believe, the demon Ruby before she switched bodies to Jared Padalecki's wife-to-be. Yeah, and not only that, she was in this great little low-budget horror superhero movie called The Scribbler. And if you ever get the chance to watch that, it is marvelous.
That sounds cool as hell.
Yeah, but no, good cast, great filmmakers. Again, we go, you know, we talk about the pedigree that all of these movies have had. Like,
forget about Kate Hudson's brother, Oliver Hudson.
As it turns out, apparently I forgot about him because I don't know who that is.
Oh, that's okay.
I met Oliver Hudson. Yay!
I'm
sorry, Oliver. If you're out there listening, I apologize.
He's right here, actually, in the room with me, and he's crying.
Ollie, I'm sorry. But no, so it actually did not play at my theater, the one that I was working at the time. So I had to travel about 30 minutes south to Huntington, West Virginia. I bought a ticket to the big new, like, 16-screen cinema there called Marquee. I walk in and I get my seat and loads of people file in because this is a horror movie at Christmas. Not only is it a horror movie at Christmas, it's a Christmas horror movie at Christmas. Like, finally the Weinsteins were like, wait a second, how could we kick this up a notch?
Yeah.
You know? And, God, I don't want to give the Weinsteins credit for fucking anything, but
yeah, they always have to come up because if you have a topic into the development hell universe, like, they are fucking in it for some reason.
That's a fact. I took my seat, and problem number one, lining up right behind me was a rowdy group of, I think, teenage girls who clearly had snuck into this R-rated film. And they were chattering, like, through the trailers, and I was like, fuck.
Not a good sign.
Not great. And so the movie begins, and I'm like, am I going to have to say something? Am I going to have to be that guy, the guy who turns around and is like, hey, I will kill your family if you don't shut up? Like, am I going to have to be that dude?
You will.
But the thing is that I actually watched enough of the movie in that first 10 minutes, and I was like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, it shows its hand.
And so we know who Billy is at the off. He kills his family. He makes skin cookies, like, bakes them and eats them.
He's also raped by his mom, which, like, I can't support it.
There
it's
is
too weird.
It makes a lot of decisions, and you know what, I turned on the movie so fast that the girls behind me, to their credit, were like this Greek chorus that made the movie going experience more enjoyable to me, because they lampooned the shit out of the film. And this was the one time in my history of going to movies that I did not, like, turn borderline homicidal at it. Not only did I not, but I actually appreciated their contributions to what I was certain was a terrible movie. Now, I had written that movie off for all time. Like, it didn't even exist. And I started hearing about a decade later, enough people pop up on podcasts trying to defend
every fucking year
this movie and saying like, oh no, Black Xmas is actually a great movie and blah, blah, blah. And it's great if you take it as a fun slasher. It's great if you don't compare it to the original. It's great if blah, 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 blah. And I was no. And you know what, Josh? One year, I was like, you know what? I'm going to prove him wrong. I'm going to pop this damn thing in. I'm going to revisit it. I'm just going to try and trudge through and just remind myself of how bad it was. And so I bought the damn DVD at my local FYE for like $5 because it was used, because I refused to buy it new. And I popped it into my player and I enjoyed the hell out of it.
Twist.
I was able to divorce it from the original movie. I was able to accept it as a dumb slasher movie. And I had a ball with that film. It makes so many utterly bizarre, bonkers decisions. It's so gonzo and out there that yeah. I cannot help but enjoy it. Like, it's so much fun.
It is gonzo as hell.
I am curious to see what you think about it.
Okay, so I remember hating it a lot the first time I saw it in 2006 in theaters with my dad. And then I had never seen it again. And then I do remember being irritated with Twitter every year, like trying to convince me that it's good. And then I decided I had a bunch of friends over last night and we put it on in the background because I couldn't put on the new one because I couldn't put on the original because I had to pay attention. So we put on this in the background and I thought, oh, I'll get a sense. And I don't know because I hated it the first time. And the second time I didn't give it my full attention. But it seemed very outrageous and not in like the best ways. That's my takeaway.
It's definitely the dumbest of the three. It's aiming the lowest. Like, yeah. I don't know what. And sure. As I understand it, like Morgan and Wong, they had some production troubles, as you will on a Weinstein
set. Yeah.
So who knows what they were attempting to do initially? Who knows if they were trying for something higher minded, something that was a bit more faithful to the original movie? Who knows? But all I know is what they wound up making is it doesn't hold a candle to the original. No. But just taken as a fun, silly slasher movie, I just think it's a blast. And by the time you get to the third act,
it's so mean-spirited, though.
So mean-spirited.
But not in a way that I've had fun with. But I don't know. I can't say. I don't have the ability to give a real opinion right now.
I would give it another decade. Just put it out of your mind and then come back to it at a later date with an open heart and a liver full of booze, and you might enjoy it.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, listen, I'm sure this isn't the last we're going to see of 2006 Black Xmas, and I wish I could say that it was. I will also say this is definitely before there was any push for any form of diversity in horror movies. It's just a bunch of pale brunettes. It was like, did Mike Flanagan direct this?
Oh.
I'm sorry, Mike Flanagan. Aww. I love you so much.
Flanagan.
I know. At least make one like a ginger. I don't know who's who.
Yeah, you know, you are right. Like, we know them all now because, you know, we know Michelle Trachtenberg. We know Mary Elizabeth Winstead. We know Lisa Chabert. But you are right. Like, you, at a glance, like, uninitiated viewers, how the hell did they tell any of them apart?
You can't. They are all the same person. Michelle Trachtenberg really not utilized properly in that film.
Nobody. And also,
how is the eyeball just everywhere? Like, the eyeball's in the ground, the eyeball's in the wall, like... How is that eyeball getting around?
And plus, I mean, well, I got to imagine it's all set up for the eyeball trauma that happens throughout the course of the movie. Because
there's just eyeball violence motif is big in that one.
The movie hates eyes is a fact.
That movie hates eyes, yeah. I just saw The Hills Have Eyes for the first time in my entire life this weekend.
Nice. Which one?
The original.
So this is also controversial and will have me run off of Twitter. But... as much as I love Wes Craven, and I do love Wes Craven, and I do enjoy his original Hills Have Eyes. I really do. I actually prefer Alex Aja's remake.
Oh, listen, as someone that only saw the original 2 days ago, yeah, same. It's not great. It's just very dated. It's very silly, the original. Like, I don't know what it would have been like to watch that in whatever year it came out. It's probably a completely different experience.
Yeah, it's funny because when you watch Alex Aja's remake, like, Craven had a hand in crafting it, and it came out right at the height of, like, the war, and, you know, like, anti-American sentiment was probably at its highest. Bush was still in office. And The Hills Have Eyes, you know, like all of the best 70s films, you know, that 2006 remake really sort of took the temperature of the country at the time and wove that into this remake that is mm-hmm. faithful to the story structurally. But, you know, what it's getting at and the themes that it sort of wrestles with along the way are very sort of its time. And not only that, but I mean, Alex Aja is no stranger to just really, really making intense stuff. And I think The Hills Have Eyes is one of the finest horror remakes that we've had in ages. And maybe
it's very divisive. I feel like people are on your side or very against you.
Yeah, but you know what? I will say it's movies like that and the Dawn of the Dead remake. You know, those were, you know, remakes that you never thought that you would see, but wound up being great. And so maybe that mm-hmm. was part of the reason that, you know, I went into Black Christmas 2006 with an open heart and open mind. And, you know, I probably shouldn't have.
Maybe not, but listen, it's a part of the narrative and we have to celebrate that it's here. Just like we have to do with Black Christmas 2019, another very, do I want to say divisive chapter in the Black Christmas universe?
You know,
some people like it and a lot of people hate it.
You're not wrong, but I feel like with Black Christmas 2006, the divisiveness comes down to quality, like the quality of the film at hand.
Yeah.
Whereas with Black Christmas 2019, like, it's divisive for way more stupid reasons.
Why don't we get into it? Are we ready to get into 2019, or do we have any, like, final thoughts, final sort of whiffs about 2006?
No, I think 2006 isn't a movie that really inspires much thought, so...
No, and I don't think it wants to. I don't think it would want us to be thinking. I think it celebrates not thinking. We're honoring it by being dumb. Yeah. The 2019 remake, I saw it in theaters. How about you?
Same.
Nice. Yeah, it came out like basically 1 year after Halloween 2018. And it was going to be Blumhouse's kind of like big IP follow-up between between Halloween 2018 and Halloween Kills. They sort of plopped it in between. And there was a lot of hype for it. And then I think a lot of people kind of felt let down once it came out. And I'm interested to know how you felt about it.
There was kind of this narrative that sprung up around it before it was released that because it was directed by a woman, it was written by a woman, you know, because it was about a group of women who were fighting back against, you know, toxic males, there was this kind of, you know, all of the people that I follow were sort of like, you know, we all couldn't wait to see it. And then there was kind of like this very loud group that was sort of decrying the fact that this movie was, you know, trying to be too woke and too this and too that. And, you know, that only put me on the movie side even more. I didn't know what the hell it was. You know, I saw the trailer and I was like, this is not my Black Christmas, but you know what? I'm going to give it a shot. Just if for no other reason than because all the wrong people are bashing the hell out of it before they've even seen it. And so I'm content to buy a ticket to it and support, you know, whatever this is going to be. That was only cemented by the fact that I think when Joe Bob said something like, I think in response to the movie coming out, he came out with this nonsense. What was it that horror movies weren't meant to be political? You know, horror movies aren't supposed to be political. And it's like,
have you ever seen a horror movie? Buddy, I didn't know about that, or I forgot.
He's not stupid, but he says the dumbest fucking things sometimes. I was fully on this movie's side, and I gotta tell you, when I watched it, I was I needed like that week. We're 2 weeks into December of 2019. Like, I gotta tell you, I needed an escape at that point. And I got it with this movie. I really, really dug the film. I still dig the film. I think it's very well made. I love the story that it tells. I love how much fun it has with its premise and the sort of subtext and how they're woven together. I will admit that I think the movie lacks some necessary punch. It's obviously, and I would be surprised if I'm wrong about this, not because I would be surprised at being wrong, but, you know, I just, the kills in the movie seem to me like they've been cut to ribbons to secure the rating that it did. You know what I mean? Like,
yes,
it,
I do.
It seems very bloodless, and I would love to see like a harder version of the movie, because that to me is the movie's only real fault. You know, it, mm-hmm. every one of the kills, you know, it pulls its punches, and, you know, it shouldn't, you know, for the type of movie it is. And I would love to know why it was edited. And I would love to know what decisions went behind that when you're following up the 1974 movie, which is notoriously like violent and dark, and the 2006 movie, which revels in slashery mayhem. Why this movie felt the need to sort of, you know, hamstring all of its kills. You know, it's just, it's such a bummer to me.
It's strange. Listen, I am also a fan. Like, I enjoyed it. It felt very 3-star to me. I think, I don't know what's her name, Imogen Poots?
Yes, love her.
Really did a great job. What a strong, strong actor she is. And she carried it great. And I did like the ensemble. I did not connect with the supernatural element. I think we could have had, we could have gone the same political route with toxic masculinity with just as much flair if it had been a straight up, like, realistic slasher. I think that they approached some topics on like surviving assault and being a victim and having agency and all that stuff. I think it did really well. I think it was beautiful even in some parts, but I think it just got messy in the storytelling, especially near the end.
I understand that. I will say that I appreciated that about it. I love that it went that batshit in its final act.
Yeah, fair.
Just because, you know, that to me really helped set it aside and set it apart from the previous films, you know.
That's true.
I feel like if you didn't have that supernatural aspect of it, then it would be very easy to look at that cult as it's like, oh, okay, instead of one Billy, we have a number of them, you know.
Yep.
But which by introducing the supernatural, like, it even stands further apart from all that's come before. And I think I think it's to its benefit. But that's just me.
Have you seen Bria Grant's Lucky?
Yes, yeah.
I think that did a similar, I think that did something similar, maybe a little bit more successfully with the metaphor of toxic masculinity being the slasher.
I can see that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I find that, also that's a dread title, so yeah, Sophia Takal. Are you familiar with her work besides Black Christmas 2019?
I am not. I was actually looking at her filmography in advance of this chat, and it occurred to me that I had not seen any of her stuff before this, or anything since, apparently.
I had seen her, is it Into the Dark, that like that Blumhouse anthology series where she did like a New Year's Eve segment that was pretty great, actually. And then I think other than that, she's done TV, basically. I think this might be her only film.
Oh, wow. That's a shame, because
so far
I do think it is a strong feature. I would love to see what else she...
It is. I hope that they didn't put her in director's jail. I feel like maybe it didn't perform so great. And I also don't think it had a great marketing push.
No, it was dumped. Like, for that title... Carried. For that title, for releasing it right around Christmas time, there should have been a huge push behind it. And it feels like it was dumped.
Yeah, I think Blumhouse hasn't had a great reputation with how they support their female filmmakers. Like, a lot of the time they end up getting designated to Welcome to the Blumhouse, and a lot of the time they find ways to not release them into cinemas. Like, kind of happened with The Craft. It happened with, like, a bunch of the Welcome to the Blumhouse chapters. I just feel like, I don't know, they don't give their women filmmakers the same distribution privileges sometimes that they could.
Which I do just want to say that I really did like The Craft.
It was fun. I didn't love it, but it was fun.
Aww.
I wasn't bored at all. I can't say that I loved it. But okay, yeah,
that's fair.
I love that you loved it, to be honest.
So wait. Did you watch the movie then? And then at the end of it, were you like, okay, I get why they didn't release it wide?
A little bit. Okay. I think that one was maybe more of a victim of circumstance in terms of the pandemic.
Oh, totally. 100%.
I think that one probably would have managed to made it into theaters. But yeah, I mean, Blumhouse, they've been working on their female filmmaker quota, so they're doing okay, I guess.
Now, can I ask, you know, so we have these three Black Christmas movies.
Okay.
Do you want to see... You know, I'm not discussing anything that you and I are eventually going to get to. I'm just talking about, mm-hmm, as far as these, mm-hmm, three go, do we want to see the franchise continue in such a way where it's just called Black Christmas and it's set in a sorority and it tells a completely different story from what's come before? Should it be...
Oh, that's genius.
Should Black like Christmas that. Be like an anthology?
I think that's great because, A, it would retroactively make these three titles make sense. Because we're getting, once you have three films with the same title, it's like you're in messy territory. But I think if you did what you're describing, it would kind of retroactively allow for it to not be stupid. So
it could be like what Halloween was meant to be around the time of Season of the Witch. You know, we have mm-hmm, Black Christmases.
I think we always BCU. Like a subtitle though. Yeah, that's cute. Yeah, I do like that. And it would be fun to get like a fraternity one, like a male gaze reversal one, sort of like they did with Slumber Party Massacre.
You know, we've already introduced the supernatural into the third movie. Give it another three or four films. We can do like Into the Christmas Verse, where we bring like, you know, 70-year-old Olivia Hussey in to meet, you know, like 30-year-old cool Imogen Poots. Why not?
And she's probably still hot as hell, too.
Oh, no doubt.
God, she's so... Everybody in Psycho 4 is hot, too. Hopefully he was at least 18 so I can talk about it. But
I think he was.
What was his name? Give me a...
We were just talking about Flanagan a second, too. Henry Thomas.
Henry Thomas, yeah. What a babe in Psycho 4. My gosh. And who is the woman that works like as the journalist, the radio broadcaster?
CCH Pounder. She is amazing.
I love that. I don't know why I love that framing in that film. It just works.
Oh, it's incredible. It's such a smart way to do it, especially with, the doctor from the end of the first film coming in to be interviewed by her character. And then I love so much that he doesn't even stick it out to the very end. Like he gets up and just huffs off. And I'm like, that's kind of perfect. You know,
it's a smart little, yeah. I mean,
I adore Psycho 4.
The secret. Yeah, me too. The secret, not secret about the Psycho movies is that they're kind of all good.
They're all good. They're all great.
Yeah, especially that second one. Meg Tilly, stop it right now.
Yeah, too talking about shipping, like, part of me, deep down, like, I know there's a massive age difference, but you know what? I kind of wanted Norman and Maureen to run off together at the end of the movie. I wanted him to find happiness, you know?
I want to be happy, too, aka in a lovely gay relationship, but, you know.
That's what they really should have, like, I wish...
He was gay as hell, and not just the actor, but I think Norman was. I think so.
You know, they did sort of pursue that a little bit, not as much as they probably should have, but they did pursue that notion in Bates Motel.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has gay face, so that would have worked out great. So do we have any final thoughts, any final things to say on the remakes before we head into secret histories and alternate realities?
No, I just want to say, I guess, in wrapping up that I think the two Black Christmas follow-ups, yeah, I mean, they do pale in comparison to the original, but in their own quite different ways, they do have their own strengths and they are fun in their own right. And they're definitely worth watching. And you know what? Before this season is out, I'm going to watch all three again.
Hell yeah. I mean, I think I'm beating you to it because I've already gotten through two. I want to watch 2019 again this year for the first time since I saw it in theaters.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. All right. So are you feeling ready? Are you feeling ready to hit into secret histories and alternate realities territory?
I'm ready to go.
We know that John Carpenter was a fan of Black Christmas, like before he made Halloween. He hired Bob Clark to direct a script for a project that never ended up making that I'd love to cover one day, titled Prey.
Yeah, what the hell was that?
I don't know, but you and I need to get to the bottom of this at some point.
So yeah, no, I totally would love to see exactly what Prey was about. It's funny, I had never heard of that until recently when I was doing a little bit of research in advance of this chat. But beforehand, you know, I talked about Fangoria 159 earlier. In that issue, Bob Clark talked about the fact that he had worked with a young writer named John Carpenter on this particular project. I don't think it was named as such. It wasn't named Prey in that article, in that interview. But he said that he knew Carpenter, they had worked together, and that he had told him that if he ever did a sequel to Black Christmas, he would do a movie about Billy basically having been placed in, you know, sort of an asylum, and he would have been there for a year. Then he would have escaped and would have come home to terrorize, you know, I don't know if it would have been Jess or who knows, but it would have happened on Halloween, and he would have called the movie Halloween. Now, later, he did an interview, I believe, with Icons of Fright, which is the interview that I think most outlets sort of reference, including Bloody Disgusting, and I think The Ringer and everyone, they all go back to that Icons of Fright interview with Clark, where he noted, as you pointed out, that it was that movie Prey that Clark was working with Halloween, Halloween Carpenter on. And that's where that conversation took place. And yeah, it all goes to, in that interview, he said, and I believe you have it quoted here. Do you want to go ahead and read the quote, what he actually said about that particular project? And
sure. I'm going to become Bob Clark. Okay. Are you ready? It's going to be really, really impressive.
Hit us.
Okay. No, I'm not. Okay, so I did a film about 3 years later, started a film with John Carpenter, and it was his first film for Warner Brothers. He asked me if I was ever going to do a sequel to Black Christmas, and I said no. I was through with horror. I didn't come into the business to just do horror. And he said, well, what would you do if you did do a sequel? And I said, well, it would be the next year, and the guy would have been caught and escaped from a mental institution, and he would go back to the house and would start all over again. It would be called Halloween.
No, that's totally it, because what's funny is he didn't quite, I think he covered it differently in the Fangoria article, but what's funny is that he actually capped the entire thing by saying something like, but I don't think John ripped me off, or he might have had a rough idea in mind, but I don't believe he directly lifted it, because he, you know, the script already came to him as Halloween and blah blah blah. But
that's right, it was already called that.
Is that that's not actually true.
Oh.
Because it was Irwin, and I think the Bloody Disgusting article, I think John Squires or Brad Miska wrote it.
Yeah, it was John Squires. Yeah.
John Squires. Okay. So John wrote and pointed out that, I'm sorry, Bob, you're actually wrong about that, because the idea came from Irwin Yablons, who had an idea to do a movie called The Babysitter Murders. He had the loose idea for it, and he passed that along to John Carpenter and Deborah Hill, and their script told the story that it did about the maniac who escaped from the asylum and came back after a year, you know, or so many years away. And and they named it Halloween. So I appreciate the fact that Bob Clark was willing to let John Carpenter off the hook
and to have his flowers. But it seems like maybe there's a middle ground here of some kind.
Yeah. I mean, there's no way that Carpenter wasn't referencing Clark's idea to some degree. There just isn't.
In the films, like, if you play them side by side, it's impossible to deny the influence.
Oh my God.
Visually and structurally.
I mean, they're companion pieces. You know, those are the two movies that set the template for what slashers are.
Yeah, they are.
So, no, I mean, I again, bless Bob Clark for letting us know that it was his idea first, but also letting Carpenter off the hook. But at the same time, like, looking at the evidence that's laid out before us, I think Halloween owes a pretty big debt to Black Christmas beyond merely following in its footsteps, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And it's not in a way that we, like, are condemning. Like, we're thrilled. Like, thank God that Black Christmas could exist, so that we could have an evolution into a film as important as Halloween. There's room for both of them, like Taylor Swift and Beyonce.
Absolutely. I can't argue that. But it does make me wonder, and shall we get into this?
Mm-hmm.
It does make me wonder, what if Bob Clark had made Halloween? What would the genre look like today? What would the slasher subgenre look like today if Bob Clark... First, I'll ask you. If Bob Clark had made a direct sequel to Black Christmas called Halloween, do you think, and we'll even say 78, we'll say it takes him 6 years for some reason, or 4 years, however long it was. Mm-hmm. We'll say it takes him that long. So it's the same year that Halloween comes out, the Carpenter film. Mm-hmm. Do you think it would have been the hit that Carpenter's movie was?
I've been thinking about this in some ways. No, I think the reason Halloween sort of accidentally became the sensation that it did had something to do with that, the mask and the cult of personality surrounding Michael Myers. And I don't think you get that or would have gotten that with this, with Billy. Because Billy, you don't have that mask. You don't have the same symbol. You don't have the same visual signals that you have with Michael Myers, which made him so literally iconic, like visually memorable. I think Billy is scarier, but I don't think you have the same touchstones for something that can be as memorable as Michael Myers with his, you know, with his quiet energy and the mask and the butcher knife. I just think no. How do you feel?
I agree with you entirely. You wouldn't, as Bob Clark would have made a fantastic film that we would, as horror fans, continue to talk about today. We would. Like every
horror fan. But we wouldn't have a franchise. We wouldn't.
I mean, we might. We might. Here's the thing. It might have done well enough. You know, if Black Christmas had done well enough to give us Halloween, Bob Clark's Halloween, then maybe Bob Clark's Halloween would have justified a handful of sequels down through the years. It's possible.
But would we wouldn't have had like a Michael Myers, though.
Now, would it have been the juggernaut of the genre that Carpenter's Halloween franchises? No, absolutely not. And you're right. It comes down to the iconography, and not just Michael Myers, not just the mask, but you know, there is something so Americana about that franchise. And, you know, the fact that it's set in small town America, that it's set in the Midwest, even though it was shot in fucking Pasadena. That I think really sort of like captured this country's imagination. And as a result, I think was a big part of its financial success. I don't think you get that if Bob Clark makes his Halloween in Toronto. You know what I mean? Like, yep. I want to see that movie so bad. I want to hop into an alternate universe and check that out. I really do. But it would not have been like this independent film sensation the Carpenter's movie wound up being. But
no,
I gotta say, it does make me wonder, like, what would the genre look like right now if that had happened? Like, if Bob Clark had made his Halloween, Carpenter could not have made his, which means mm-hmm. that we no longer have the Halloween franchise. We have to remove that.
Why would you do that to us?
We have to pull them all out of existence. They no longer exist, right? But in their place, understanding that it's likely not to be as successful as the franchise that no longer exists, what does the Billy franchise look like?
It's scarier in a more disturbing, less fun way, I think. And I don't think you'd have Jason either. Like, I don't think the modern slasher would have ever been born if that had been the alternate reality.
No, because, I mean, if Halloween hadn't been a juggernaut, like, Cunningham wouldn't have been looking to rip it off, you know?
No, so then you probably wouldn't have Freddy in some ways either.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's hard to say with that one. Freddy's a wild card in all the ways.
Freddy's a wild card, and plus that was born out of a lot of Craven's own personal concerns and background. So I would like to think that we would still.
But maybe I don't know if that would it have succeeded as much if it wasn't for the trend instilled by Halloween.
All I know is that one way or another, in 2003, we would have had a Freddy versus Billy. So
cool. Well, watch out, Freddy. I'm worried for you, girl, because Billy seems like he's a lot to handle.
I don't know, but you know, if we had had that Bob Clark's Halloween, you know, Billy escapes from a mental asylum. He goes after a young girl babysitting on Halloween night. Like, why wouldn't it be called Black Halloween? Who knows?
Or Red Halloween? No, that's terrible.
You know, but what follows that? Could we have, follow with me here. Could we have Black Thanksgiving? Wherein Billy goes after his twin brother and mother at their remote apartment community and discovers that, hey, that's not cranberry sauce. Could we have Black New Year's, where Billy phones up a punk rock TV host and lets her know that he's going to kill a naughty girl every time the clock strikes midnight in each time zone?
You're getting him in all of them.
Could we have, Josh?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm here.
Black Valentine. Wherein Billy stalks a group of women in San Francisco just before Valentine's Day in a Cupid mask and may also feature in a depressing subplot about marriage going to ruins and Billy goes down on Michelle Williams. I don't know.
But he would kill Denise Richards, though.
As well he should. No, I mean, okay, all joking aside, like, I do...
Oh my god, I just got your Blue Valentine joke. Very funny. Sorry.
I'm glad that you did. I'm sorry. I thought
it took me a second, but I got there and I'm so proud that I did.
But, you know, okay, I'm being silly with those four, but let's actually consider for a second what that franchise might have become. Do you think, like, if Clark gets from Black Christmas to, hey, the next one will be set on another holiday, if his Halloween had been successful enough, do you think he would have just continued on bouncing back and forth between Christmas and Halloween?
No,
or do you think he would have gone to another?
I think Bob Clark hates horror. I think he's just a very talented filmmaker, so he made an amazing horror movie. I just don't ever see Bob Clark pursuing the franchise.
I don't know that I can't say that Bob Clark hates horror.
I get the sense from some of the quotes that he's delivered over the years.
Maybe he's a guy, though, like, maybe he's like
pretentious about it. Yeah.
In that, like, he just didn't want to be pigeonholed, you know, because he...
Well, that's true.
You know, if you look at his career...
I'm very sensitive when I hear filmmakers... say negative things about my genre.
I mean,
very
he did,
mean about it.
Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, Death Dream, Black Christmas, and then Murder by Decree, which is literally about Jack the Ripper. Like, this is a man who he may not have wanted to have gotten pigeonholed, and maybe he just wanted to do other stuff and stretch.
A Christmas Story is scary as hell.
You know, I thought he was going to shoot his eye out at some point. I thought we were going to see it, but...
The tongue's scary.
You know, I gotta say the peephole in Porky's is a little stalkery. That's something.
No, there's nothing scarier than Porky's. That's for sure. Oh, you're so right. Actually, the peephole in Porky's versus the peeping Tom element of Black Christmas. It's actually quite similar.
You know, it's funny. I never would have considered it before. But do you think Morgan and Wong were referencing another Bob Clark movie when they remade Black Christmas with Porky's?
Do you think they even knew? Do you think they even knew what they were doing in that moment? Because it's possible. Because it's very similar.
You know, watching the movie, I can't imagine they knew much.
No. Brat, it's just like rats eating their brains. Rats on the brain.
No, but I wonder, okay, do you think he would have continued down the holiday train then? And if so, what would have been the next one he would have gone after, do you think?
Maybe it wouldn't have been a holiday. Maybe it would have been Black Summer. And it would have been like a surf musical. Like a 50s surf musical. That's my official answer.
I think Black Valentine is more likely than that.
Yeah, and that sounds good too.
No, I mean, you know, having it was meant to be a dumb gag, but now that I say it out loud, I would watch a movie called Black Valentine.
Yeah, it sounds dangerous but sexy.
There's leather involved somewhere in there. I don't know.
Yeah. Leather, try patent latex.
Why not both? You know, maybe Clark did leave horror behind entirely after Murder by Decree, which admittedly wasn't even a horror movie with capital H. So, you know, if the franchise were to have continued, let's say he even went as far as making Bob Clark's Halloween, right? Then maybe he wouldn't have done any more after that. But do you think the franchise, say his Halloween had been at least as successful as Black Christmas, maybe that franchise, the Billy franchise, would have continued on without him. What do you think?
I would have liked to see how that could have gone. It's hard to say now that we are in the future, because we saw how the whole slasher phase turned out, and it became a bit of like cult of personality. And I think Billy does that, but like it does it in like a less fun, more realistic way with the horror of his like mental health. So I don't know. I don't know. I'd be very interested to see how it all would have turned out. I do know that there a fan film that came out this year is all about like the lineage of Billy and really? The lineage of Jess. Yes. So have you heard about It's Me, Billy, the big fan film sequel to Black Christmas that came out this year?
Oh, tell me.
So It's Me, Billy is like an unofficial fan film by filmmakers Dave McRae and Bruce Dale. And it features a character that's the granddaughter of Jess, aka Olivia Hussey. And she's very aware of her grandmother's, what her grandmother has survived.
So wait a second. So, can I ask you a question then?
Please, gosh.
Does that mean that Jess did not have that abortion?
I mean, maybe it does, or maybe this was like a kid that she had down the line, but it's definitely, I've only seen the trailer for the film. I haven't seen the whole thing, so I'd be very interested to know if she did or if she didn't. Honestly, I hope she did, because I'm rooting for her to have her own agency.
Yeah.
You know that if there was going to be a sequel ever involving Jess, that unborn child would be a major plot point.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Because it almost feels a little bit unresolved by the end of Black Christmas 1974.
Do you feel like she would almost, and this is icky, but I'm just saying, like, considering where we leave her at the end of that movie.
Oh my God.
Do you think she would have felt in some weird way more than she ever would have before, more than she would have with Peter actually, you know, sort of trying to browbeating her? But given that she killed Peter, do you think she would have felt obligated to go ahead and have the child at that point?
It would be like one or the other. It would have been absolutely like she probably would have had to like even more reason or more incentive to not keep the kid. Also, because she probably believes that he's the murderer. I'm going to say no. I'm going to say that it probably was just more incentive for her to continue on her choice.
Okay.
Because I think she's leaving that situation believing that her boyfriend's, like, murderous. And then that's going to leave. That's going to give you baggage with your unborn child, for sure.
Josh, before we move forward, I just want to ask you. This is something that we have not discussed at this point.
Uh-huh.
But given that we talked about the potential of Bob Clark's Halloween and whatnot, now we're talking about Jess having grandkids and whatnot,
uh-huh.
I got to ask, what do you think happens in the next 5 minutes after Black Christmas ends?
This is so important. This is very important. I really want to say that Jess survives, but the way that they frame that ending, where you just, you see... You see Lynn Griffin, I think, in the attic for like 5 minutes as those credits roll. I don't think Jess lives.
I mean,
I think Jess dies.
I'm with you. Like, I want Jess to survive so badly, but my question is,
she doesn't.
How?
She doesn't. And this is a mean movie, and this is a movie that I think would have the balls to do something real rude.
100%.
Like, kill Jess.
And I think, do you think Bob Clark is ending his movie on a question mark or an exclamation point when it comes to Jess?
I think he's allowing his audience to make up their own mind. So if they want to have some form of comfort, they can, but they're lying to themselves, because I think ultimately the real truth is that that's not a happy ending.
My
God. That is a bad, bad, bad ending.
Josh, something just occurred to me.
Oh my God, I'm scared.
So if he kills Jess.
Jess is dead.
And Halloween is all about Billy breaking out of the asylum and going to a town and haunting a babysitter. Because Jess wouldn't have been a babysitter, right?
Mm-hmm. She'd have been a little too old.
John Saxon is totally the Sam Loomis character in the
movie. Oh, see, he's
angry because he lost the girl that he might have saved because of his own fuck up, and then he would have felt compelled to be the guy who brings down Billy when he escapes. John Saxon would have been the Dr. Loomis figure.
What do they call it in Behind the Mask? What do they call that archetype?
He would have been
from Moby Dick.
He would have been the Ahab.
The Ahab. He's total Ahab. Because you don't really get an Ahab in the first Nightmare on Elm Street either. So he's not really that there. But yeah, he's the Ahab of that franchise for sure.
I want to see that sequel so badly now just because of that.
Oh, Johnny. Interesting. I'm kind of obsessed with all of these possibilities. All of these potential timelines, as one would say.
Well, that's the thing. When we talk about development hell, it's just not about the things that were developed and not made, but it's also all of the possibilities, all of the might have beens.
And speaking of, oh yes, please finish your thought.
No. That's all really, because I mean, it's all about the what ifs, and especially mm-hmm. if there's the tease. And Bob Clark can't just tell a story about how he might have made Halloween before John Carpenter and not expect all of us to run wild with those possibilities.
Speaking of, untapped possibilities, I'm not going to give you much information about it, but there is a very easy to find sort of fanfic outline for potential Black Christmas 2, a follow-up to the 2006 remake online, which is hysterical and has all of this like fantasy casting in it too, including Emily from Pretty Little Liars. I'm going to cut this out because I forget her name. And I suggest looking it up. Google Black Christmas 2 if you want to get a sense of what people were thinking of for a follow-up for that remake.
Oh my God. And pretty hilarious. With the Weinsteins too, you know, like the poster would have been Black Xmas 2, but it would mm-hmm. have been like X-M-A and then like a spun around S that kind of looks like a 2. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Ooh, or what if the 2 on the poster, so it's like a string of Christmas lights and all the Christmas lights have sort of died except for 2 that are right next to each other and they're blinking.
Oh, I like that. I like that a lot.
Thank you. I'm gonna have to get a pitch deck together for this one. If you could give a sequel, a direct sequel to either of the remakes, which one would you pick?
To either of the remakes? Ooh.
Yeah. I would also say including the original, but then you're obviously just going to pick the original. So why don't I cut it down to the remake?
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and pick the original for 2 seconds and just say I would totally be down for the 2018 style reboot with like an aged Olivia Hussey being cool. miserable for 40 years and fucking up her family, waiting for Billy to return one day. Like,
is she not the house mother? Are we not going to do that to her?
Yeah, I mean, I would be fine with that too. But out of the other two, you know, I got to say this. I would not elect to do a follow-up to any of them. I would just keep the Black Christmas train rolling the way it is and do yes. another movie with female leads in a sorority house in a Christmas setting with, you know, a male antagonist or villain and mm-hmm. just tell a completely different story with a different perspective, you know, and I would be, you know, and if it continues down that route, which I think it should, because, you know, even the first two movies, you had male filmmakers at the helm, but it was still very much like female-led stories, you know? So mm-hmm. I want to see more Black Christmases with female filmmakers, you know? I want to see that perspective in that setting, and I want to see more stories in that world under that banner.
It'd be cool if someone like Blumhouse did a TV show where, like, December, they do, like, you know, 5-hour-long TV movies all sort of in that universe.
You know, if we can just crack how to spell Christmases, then I think
Christmas I.
Exactly. Then I think they're onto something. So
I am obsessed with all things Black Christmas. And honestly, this conversation just leaves me wanting desperately to revisit 2019. Because I think that's what's next for me.
Excellent. I think me too. I'm gonna rewatch the first two and then yeah, it's going to culminate with that 2019 again because you know what? We need to start leading the charge, Josh. You and I on Twitter. We need to start leaning hard on Blumhouse and we need to find out where the harder cut of that movie is and where the 4K UHD super duper special edition from like Scream Factory or Vinegar Syndrome is.
Release the tackle cut.
I mean,
release it. Am I saying her name wrong? Probably. I'm really sorry, Sophia.
No, it's cool. It's but no, I yes, yes, I think we need that.
Okay. Well, we're gonna have to start our letter writing campaign the second we hit. The second we hang up today. So I think we have work ahead of us.
We do. We do. That's gonna be our Christmas gift to all horror fans out there. Is that by the 25th of this month, we are gonna get an announcement. We are going to pull an announcement out of Jason Blum concerning the rated cut of Black Christmas 2019.
He's just waiting to hear from us. He is just waiting to hear from us. And by the end of the month, we're going to have four full episodes of Christmas is Canceled out into the ether, which I'm super excited about. I was going to ask, do you think we should give like a tease right now about what next week is going to be? But then I thought, no, I think it should be a secret.
In its own way, that's a tease.
Oh my God. We're just full of teases today. Jinx, even though you are official co-host for this miniseries, can you still tell us where you can be found on the internet if you wanted to be found?
Yes, find me on Twitter. I am at Jinx1981. That's at JINX1981. You can also find me on Instagram. It's a ridiculous amount of numbers. I know. I apologize in advance. It's at Jinx740941. I apologize. That's at JINX740941. You can find me online at Bloody Disgusting. Find my writing there. You can also find my podcast at ScreamAddicts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. So whether it be iTunes or Stitcher or honestly, whatever you kids listen to your podcasts on these days, it's going to be there.
I love to hear that, Jinx. And I promise that at the end of 4 weeks, we'll let you out of the basement. But for now, we're going to have to deliver you the sandwiches through the slot in the door.
Yeah. Okay. So I've had enough sandwiches. These chains are starting to chafe. I would like some milk and some skin.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening. And we'll be back with another episode of Development Hell.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.